Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about consolidating ideas arising from Newton's first and second laws of motion. So there's something to be said of moving forward on just introducing people to the ideas which are going to come from Newton's first and second law of motion before you get into Newton's third law of motion. So the first law is the law of motion. It's the law of motion. It's the law of inertia. The second law is the law of force and mass and acceleration, F equals ma. The third law is the law of momentum, or for equal, every force is an equal and opposite force. Getting to the third law is really loading up your brain, but what we have to actually say is, well, it's probably worthwhile to stop and see what you can, how far you can go with the first and second law of motion, Newton's law. The first law of inertia, I suppose there's phenomenological things you can see. This is the vase staying still when you rip the tablecloth from underneath, or the person, the crash test dummy flying through the front of a car without the safety belt, so there's no force acting on it, so you can go through there. But sort of the important thing about the Newton's first law is that it's a description, and if that description holds, and you can see you're in a frame of reference for which the first law holds, that's called an inertial frame. So if that law doesn't hold, and something, if you hold something and it's at rest and it begins to accelerate, it's a non-inertial frame. And yes, this is something to get in the mind. So if I'm in deep space and I let go of a spanner, the spanner's just going to say where my hand is. But if I'm on the planet Earth and my foot is underneath it and I drop the spanner, I will definitely see it not staying still. So how do we actually mimic that law of inertia? So this is getting a bit more complex. We have partial inertial frames, that is, or pseudo-inertial frames. Okay, so a partial inertial frame would be a ball which has a normal force and a weight force equaling it, so it's got no net force in the vertical direction due to the fact that it's rolling on a table, and then there's no force in the X and Y direction. And bear in mind that X and Y are all Cartesian stuff, and Newton hated Rene Descartes, and how he ever calculated anything, it boggles the mind how that man worked, how Newton worked. So we have a limited inertial frame of a table or the floor of a train. So a train itself is not an inertial frame, but it's a limited inertial frame. Now, what will happen is, indeed, there are lots of exam questions where students get marked correct for saying that a train travelling at a constant velocity is in an inertial frame. And we sort of get almost bullied into just ticking that off. But, you know, let's be honest here. That's not correct, because it's not inertial. I can actually hold my mobile phone and just drop it, and that mobile phone will drop down. Is it limited? Does it have a limited inertial frame? Yes, it does, if it's not accelerating or turning a corner. That is, a ball rolling on a table, if you're playing billiards, a billiard table is on a on the train, you can do your billiard shot and nothing will happen or go there. But if it suddenly accelerates or turns a corner, you'll see the balls act as if there's an imaginary force on it. So that's limited inertial frame in deep space, limited inertial frame, and a pseudo-inertial frame. A pseudo-inertial frame is in a space station. Now, there again, have you not heard of limited and pseudo? Well, the reason is that I've made it up. Sorry for you guys. The average teacher who hears me make up something up, they'll just run away and say, "No, I'm not teaching it." But you're out in podcast land. It really, really doesn't matter. The pseudo inertial frame is in a space station. It does look as though you've got X, Y, and Z in a space station. If I hold the ball, if I release a ball out of my hand in a space station, it will sit there in space. And if I push it, it will travel in what looks like a straight line. But obviously, it's not traveling in a straight line. It's actually going in a circle. That ball is going in a circle around the Earth. It's not traveling straight at all. So the frame is a pseudo one. And the way I can say it's pseudo is that if I have three balls and I have them at rest, all sitting themselves at in the space station, what will happen is those three balls over time will drift apart due to tidal effect. Get that in your head. It's what I call pseudo inertial frame, a close approximation to an inertial frame. It's in free fall, and everything is in free fall. It's hard. You have to do a really subtle test to prove that one axis of that is a non inertial frame. In fact, well, yeah, look, there's a whole heap of things. Obviously, it's not inertial. You've got Coriolis forces and all these other pseudo forces coming in. So you've got an inertial frame. This is just not going very far in the first law. I promise that I'll do the first and second law. And this is why I think it's really important to stop at this point in time and teach this aspect of it, because if you've taught things badly, first badly, second badly, third badly, and then the next one badly, you're not going to get there. So you may as well start off teaching the first one well and actually going into inertial frame, limited inertial frame, and pseudo inertial frame, because that's going to be important there. I'm just trying to think. I just have to remember. I have to go back into the physics course on what inertial frames are relevant to the later physics course. I've forgotten it straight off the top of my brain. I'll have to ask. It would be nice if I could speak to a fellow teacher and get it off. Just dial someone up, but I can't do that at this point in time. Now, I promise that we should, at this time, you really should go first law, second law pretty quickly, because the second law, the first law, you define acceleration. It's sort of a bit hanging there. What's the use of it? Define acceleration, because the first law is so much more easily put in terms of not using acceleration, but acceleration is really necessary to get the second law. Get to the second law, sum of external forces on a body equals the resultant force equals, okay, equals the mass of the body times the acceleration of the body. How can we actually, what can we do with that? That's the law of force and mass for acceleration. Let's simplify that by dropping the body and the terms and the sum terms and body, and say just simply F equals ma. But F equals ma is sort of like a brand, a tag. It's patently inadequate or untrue. I don't know how you could describe it. It's sort of like a sign for something deeper. It's sort of the label, the packaging of something. It's just sort of like a chapter heading, like chapter 6 or something. It tells you what's inside that door. It's like an aid memoir, but it doesn't do it. It's sort of like having saying 36 pepper, and that's an aid memoir to remember that you are cooking for 36 people and you've got to remember to buy the pepper or something like that. It actually doesn't tell you what you're cooking. It actually, F equals MA does not really tell you how to do F equals MA. It's because it's applied to a body and it's a sum of forces. We could start with the F equals MA though. because it's a good way to manipulate it. Now, there's several things you can do with F equals MA. You can multiply both sides by D, F times D. D is the distance in meters. And we're just put that off, remember in your brain, F times D, and M times A times D. Now, we're going to change that into all velocities. So FD equals M, something to do with velocities. Now the acceleration is VF minus VI on delta T. Change in time, the delta velocity over the delta T, VF minus VI on delta T. And the distance travelled is the average velocity times the delta T. So the average velocity is VF plus VI divided by 2 times the delta T. Now, if you can just get that into your head, probably write it down, jot it down. F dot D equals M. And we're going to change this around. We're just going to move the delta T in the front so it's easier for you to remember. VF minus VI on delta T times delta T times V. VF plus VI on 2. So if you notice, I've divided by delta T to multiply by delta T really quickly. I'm doing that in your head, so I'm actually moving those terms, so I'm cancelling together. So F times D equals M V final minus V initial into V final plus V initial divided by 2. Divided by 2 is VF plus VF, V force times distance equals a half M VF minus VI into VF plus VI. Now, if you multiply VF minus VI into VF plus VI, the cross central term will cancel. You have to have a little bit of math to do it. And it will be F times D equals a half M V final squared minus VI squared. And if we defined, if we then multiply the half M into both those things, that equation, expand it, it gets F times D equals a half M VF squared minus a half M VI squared. Now, with the age of cultural clout, this is how it was done, my friends. What people said is that we are now going to define words for it. Now, teachers often teach us the opposite way around, but you just have to bear with me. I now hereby define forevermore in English the word force. It's defined scientifically as force times distance, and I now hereby scientifically say that a half mv squared is the kinetic energy. So the work done on a mass equals the change of kinetic energy. So that's Newton's second law, gives you that equation. Now what happens is that people don't know this derivation, they just string the students along and teach them straight away, or they prove work and force by something, but it's actually not a proof because it's declarative. I declare F times D to be work, and I declare a half mv squared to be energy. Of course, everything adds up then. 13 minutes in, well, let's give you another thing. Because this is where it's really got to take off. Small bits, small chunks. Newton's first law, Newton's second law. I convert them from the verbiage to the words. And in doing that, you can teach it. And our third part of a four-part series, it may be five-part series, we're going to say what we've modified things. We've gone and explored Newton's first law into inertial frames, and I've introduced these new types of inertial frames never known before in the history of the world. But that's what research scientists do. They just think and they propose, and they're not too concerned if they're wrong, that if they're proven wrong, they say thank you. If they're ignored, they just shrug their shoulders and go away. So I'm just saying that there's more inertial frames. There's a partial inertial frame that's on the surface of the Earth on a flat table, an air pack table, or a pseudo inertial frame, which is in a space station, but they're all what inertial frames are. And then I've told you about work being the change in the kinetic energy, a conservative system, mind you, to I suppose work out what's going on here. But the F equals ma gives you declaratively what work is. Work is declared to be the first part of the equation, and kinetic energy is declared to be the second part of the equation. Next one is F equals ma. So we've done basically two explorations, which are, I suppose, declarative. I declare this to be an inertial frame. I declare that to be work. I declare it to be kinetic energy. The next one is multiplying F equals ma by T on both sides. And this is a little bit simpler to get your mind around. And it's not so much declarative, it's more analytical. But it's also definitions of momentum. F times T, which we're going to declare what that is later on, equals m Vf minus Vi on delta T by delta T. So divided by delta T, multiplied by delta T, scratch, 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 that's one. So Ft equals m Vf minus m V initial. See, when I say V final, although you might think that's a velocity hyphen final, it's written V subscript F. So that's important to get that subscript language in. And so I have Ft as the impulse. I declare that quantity, the force on an object, as the impulse given to an object, equals the change in momentum of that object, because I declare MB, I declare it to be the momentum. And in fact, when you look at Newton, Newton actually worked out what the momentum is, but he basically had a declarative description system, that system there. So just to really summarize it once again, first one is we did Newton's first law and found out the different inertial frames, and being able to say, look, this is an inertial frame, the laws apply from here. The second one, which we can apply for situations which aren't an inertial frame, we can use it for F equals ma to describe an object falling. So that's obviously not an inertial frame. We multiplied both sides by d to get a declaration that the work is the change of in kinetic energy. And then the second thing is we multiplied both sides by t and declared certain things to be impulse and declared it to be momentum. And it's important to say it's declared because these are separate, conceptually different things. A momentum feels different, sorry, an impulse feels different from a momentum, and they result in different things. And there's no way that you can actually prove one is the other because they're all declared. Thanks for listening and see how this goes. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.